Christianity says, without blinking, standing on that hill of facticity and bodily resurrection, stands on that hill and says, if Jesus is not raised, you are still in your sins, and we are liars.
Yeah, right. Mike's absolutely right. That is the nature of the claim. Our claim is tied to particular historical events that either did happen or did not happen.
And
if they did happen, Christianity is true. If they didn't, Christianity is false.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we're dealing with objections to the resurrection. The White Horse Inn, know what you believe and why you believe it.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. And Ken Jones isn't with us, but sitting in with the rest of the team here on the White Horse Inn is Craig Parton. You've heard Craig before on the program. Craig is the author of Religion on Trial, as well as other tremendous books that help you defend your faith to those who have questions about it. He also directs the Institute for Law and Apologetics in Strasbourg, France. Craig, thanks for being on.
Thank you. My privilege. Enjoy being back.
Folks, you wouldn't know it from the popular media, especially with religious celebrities like Bishop John Spong, but when it comes to Christ's resurrection, even liberals are recognizing and lamenting a trend in New Testament scholarship away from the many assured results assumed by their predecessors only a generation ago. Now, a lot of factors have contributed to this more conservative trend, but two are worth mentioning. First, there's been a trend toward earlier dating of the gospel accounts, which undermines the critical presupposition that the most obvious reports of Jesus' bodily resurrection and deity are later interpolations. Second, especially since the last 40 years or so, there's been a trend toward placing Jesus in his Jewish milieu instead of seeing him as some kind of a Greek sage anticipating Bishop Spong. And this has led, generally speaking, to greater suspicion of the very Gentile, Greek, biases that have dominated higher critical, that is, liberal, scholarship. But it's really helpful for us to return to the facts of the case concerning the resurrection. And here, speculation is just useless. It doesn't matter what we thought about reality, what we thought the world was like. It doesn't matter what we find helpful, meaningful, or fulfilling. This isn't about spirituality or moral uplift. Something has happened in history, and we can't wish it away. It either happened or it didn't happen, but the claim itself is hardly meaningless or beyond investigation. We had an interview with Michael Shermer, the editor of Skeptic Magazine, who, by the way, was at one time an evangelical Christian, and had the opportunity to unpack some of Shermer's comments with Greg Kokel. We're going to listen to a couple of these claims by Michael Shermer here now with the panel. Here's the first one.
What would it mean to discover that there was a God? It really wouldn't mean anything to me. In any case, I'm not particularly worried about it, because why would a deity care one way or the other whether I believed or not? I mean, isn't it more important how you comported yourself in life, how you treated other people, how you behaved? You know, works instead of words in the classic debate about how you get to heaven. I think it matters more how you behave. And even if there isn't a God, shouldn't we be doing these nice things to help other people and being moral and honoring your word and your commitments and truth-telling and all that stuff? I mean, shouldn't we be doing that anyway? And I think everybody would answer, well, yeah, of course. So what difference does it make whether there's a God or not?
It sounds like he wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to say, look, it doesn't matter whether there is a God or whether we believe in a God, as long as we live ordered, meaningful, purposeful, moral lives. Well, why? Why would there be order, purpose, meaning, and why on earth would you have any obligation to love your neighbor instead of be a totalitarian dictator?
Exactly. If God is not in existence, there's no standard for morality anyway. Lewis deals with this in Mere Christianity. I thought his comments about living the moral life were interesting. I mean, Lewis's point in Mere Christianity is you can't. The moral law condemns you. Forget the law of God.
Right.
You don't
right.
need to get
yeah.
there.
Right.
You can't live consistent with your own standards.
Right, regardless of what they are.
Right.
So now where?
Even the philosopher Kant had to bring in a judgment, at least theoretical, judgment.
Yeah.
Because he was smart enough to realize that most of us wouldn't do, as Mike mentioned, the noble, the wonderful, the generous. There are some of us who would do just the opposite.
Because we know that the male lion, when taking over a pride, will kill the female who is in charge of the pride and bring his own female into the pride. Well, if animals behave like this, and we're all just simply the product of evolution without any kind of divine intention or design, then why do we order societies? Why do we have laws? Why do we keep things like that? Why do we think that's even wrong?
He needs a standard to judge behavior on, and he's already cut himself off from that by denying the existence of the transcendent or the existence of God.
Yeah.
So at least Friedrich Nietzsche was consistent when he said, look, you can't have the fruit without the tree.
Right.
You can't have Christian morality. We're living off of a residual Christian morality without the doctrine. And Nietzsche at least had the courage to chart his own path, which was then picked up by Hitler and Stalin.
National socialism, yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to the next clip.
Equally intelligent, thoughtful people around the world have equally strong claims to truth about their religion. How are we to resolve that? I mean, is there some experiment we could run that go, hey, look, the Christian religion really is right, and this one over here really is wrong?
Okay, what do we make of that one?
It sounds like all religions are making factual claims. That's not the case.
Yes. Not at all.
I mean,
yeah.
if you ask the world religions and the cults, why should I believe you? You'll get a common, well, it changed my life, it helps your blood pressure, it gives you this X, Y, and Z. Christianity comes back and says, because it's true. Check the facts. Check the evidence. Look at the records. He's avoiding that.
Yeah. Can you imagine anything parallel to... in fact, I talked to even Muslims and Jews, whose religion is probably the closest in terms of making historical claims. And at the end of the day, when you make arguments, historical arguments for the resurrection of Christ, and ask them to offer similar evidence on their side, they will very often capitulate and say, okay, I mean, maybe it's hard to find all the arguments and evidence, but Allah, this is the burning in my bosom. This is what I've experienced, or what have you. And yet Christianity says, without blinking, standing on that hill of facticity and bodily resurrection, stands on that hill and says, look, for us, there is no consolation prize. For us, there's no fallback strategy. For us, there's not, well, even if it isn't true, haven't you lived a better life?
Yeah.
For us, it's if Jesus is not raised, you are still in your sins, and we are liars.
Yeah.
Right.
Mike's absolutely right. That is the nature of the claim. Our claim is tied to particular historical events that either did happen or did not happen.
And
if they did happen, Christianity is true. If they didn't, Christianity is false.
That's right. And the last thing you mentioned is significant. We can specify a factual state of affairs which, if it were the case, would cause Christians to walk away from Christianity. Try asking that of another religious position.
Sadly, there have been a spate of recent evangelical leaders, many of them tied to presidency runs and other things, on major evangelical media. And when pressed on their commitment to Christianity, fall back to the same thing. Well, who am I to judge? This has given my life meaning. This has brought me fulfillment. This has given me happiness and purpose. They fall
you
right back to that same default setting of the subjective.
Here's another clip.
I think the question of Jesus' historicity is separate from that of the miraculous resurrection, him being all human and all God in one body. Those are two different questions. We can answer this historicity question. I think there probably was somebody named Jesus of Nazareth that lived and died and so forth, but that's quite separate from saying, well, then he rose from the dead and then he performed these miracles and that sort of thing. Lots of people were performing miracles. You know, if you heal the blind, what does that mean? Were they really blind, or maybe they weren't really blind? I mean, did he actually reach in and reconstruct the retina? I mean, what exactly happened there? Or was it just a magic trick, or was it some kind of they weren't really blind, or, you know, maybe he wasn't really dead if he was resurrected.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me there when he says maybe they were not really blind, it's not just the Gospels that recount the anger of the religious leaders at Jesus' healing of people and the crowd's amazement at this. It is the Babylonian Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, that says Jesus performed sorcery in order to lead Israel astray.
Even the historical narrative from Josephus, not the edited one, but even the bare bones one, claims that Jesus was a miracle worker. I mean, this is very clear that those who opposed Christ opposed him precisely because he performed miracles.
Yeah, and even in the accounts themselves in the Gospels, one of the charges is, all right, he's done these things, but he does it by the power of Beelzebul.
Yeah.
They didn't go up against the healing, they went up against the how.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, Mr. Shermer's lightness with the connection between miracles and the deity of Christ. Centuries of people have said it's made or broken here, and somehow he sees that this is not even really an issue.
What really troubles me as a trial lawyer is to see that he ignores the eyewitness accounts of who was there recording this, who saw how it happened, and says, but isn't it possible there's another explanation living now 2,000 years later? That would never fly in a court. The people who were there saw it, recorded it, say X. The burden's on you to come up with a more reasonable, based on the facts and the evidence, explanation.
And here are some of those facts, even from hostile witnesses. Even Marcus Borg, co-founder of the Skeptical Jesus Seminar, concedes that Christ's death by Roman crucifixion is the most certain fact about the historical Jesus. There are numerous attestations to these facts from ancient Jewish and Roman sources. Here are just a few of them. I'll run through them quickly. In the Talmud, I refer to the Jewish Talmud, Yeshua was a false prophet hanged on Passover Eve for sorcery and blasphemy. So he claimed to be God, regardless of what you can't turn him into this pale Galilean who was just telling people to be nicer to each other. He was charged with sorcery and blasphemy. No less a towering Jewish scholar than Joseph Klausner identified the following references to Jesus in the Talmud. Jesus was a rabbi whose mother, Mary, was married to a carpenter who was nevertheless not the natural father of Jesus. Jesus went with his family to Egypt as a child, returned to Judea, and made disciples, performed miraculous signs by sorcery, led Israel astray, and was deserted at his trial without any defenders. On Passover Eve, he was crucified.
Wow.
Suetonius, who lived from 75 to 130 AD, was a Roman official and historian. He recorded the expulsion of Jews from Rome in 48 AD because of a controversy erupting over a certain Christ. Late in the first century, Tacitus, the greatest Roman historian, referred to the crucifixion of Jesus under Pontius Pilate. In a letter to Emperor Trajan around the year 110, Pliny the Younger, governor of what is now Turkey, was writing to the emperor to pass along a report about this burgeoning movement of Christians who were worshiping Jesus as God, celebrating the Lord's Supper, baptizing, all of the elements that we have of early Christian worship, already there, a pagan testifying to this. There simply isn't enough time for a big fish story to emerge. Hume is right. David Hume, when he said that there's a tendency of miracle reports to be like big fish stories. If you know, the people who are actually in the boat with you could push your arms together as you're showing people how big the fish was. But as it gets wider and wider and the story gets told, it just gets bigger and bigger. But the problem here is the maximal claim, he is risen, he is not here, he is risen,
right,
began in Jerusalem,
right
under
mm-hmm.
the nose of the authorities, where a body could have been produced but wasn't. And it didn't evolve over time. It was the earliest claim of the earliest Christians.
F.F. Yeah. Bruce makes a great point when he says, every time the gospel's preached, especially in the opening chapters of the book of Acts, it's preached to people who have the means, the motive, and the opportunity to adduce evidence or claims to show that message to be false. And had it been common knowledge that Jesus was a sorcerer who didn't actually do these things, they would have been shouted down and driven out of the... It had been ended before it started.
Yeah.
So maybe he didn't really die. Shermer is suggesting.
Well,
physicians will tell us that he did. They had a lot of practice. And even Pilate said, go check. If he isn't dead, break his legs.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no indication that people in the first century didn't know if somebody was dead or alive.
Especially Roman soldiers and governors.
Yeah. Exactly.
And they were pretty good at crucifixion.
They're pretty good.
And didn't the Journal of the American Medical Association
yes.
do an 1986 yep. journal yes. piece on the medical pathology of yes. just yep. from the Gospels, and the separation of blood and water from the pericardium is
yep.
just a sign that he was dead and his heart was not beating when he was stuck with the spear.
Yeah, the Journal of the American Medical Association brings together a team of medical experts, and they all conclude unanimously that Jesus died according to what was known in the first century about medicine and the descriptions in the Gospels.
Right. And by the way, Shermer's comment about we should still keep the morality. I mean, you look at Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. I'm looking at verse 32 where he says, basically, if this is a lie, eat, drink, and be merry.
Yes.
I mean,
so,
the alternative is hedonism. It's
yes.
not morality.
Right. That's a huge point.
Isn't it significant, too, that, you know, you look for embarrassment. Even liberal New Testament scholars will say that's a criterion. If a witness is embarrassed in telling a piece of the story, then it has a lot of plausibility. Well, the burial of Jesus in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, one of the leaders of the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, while the disciples represent themselves as having fled the scene.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that have been embarrassing?
Well, the psychological situation is such that the Jews took the rumors seriously enough that they posted a guard while the disciples split.
Right.
That's amazing.
Or no Jew is going to write that the first two witnesses of the resurrected Christ were women.
I think we can't underestimate what Kim was saying about the fact that there were means, motive, and opportunity for the opposition to produce the body.
Yes.
And I can tell you that you can get a jury instruction in California that says if somebody has the means, motive, opportunity to produce exculpatory evidence, and they don't, you can assume as a juror that the event occurred.
Wow. Interesting.
I mean, they have the opportunity to refute it. It's within their power. They don't. You can presume from that they have no ability to refute it.
Doug Powell has an interesting observation also in his Holman Quick Source Guide to Christian Apologetics, which I highly recommend. It's a great resource. He says that in addition to surviving the spear piercing his heart and one of his lungs, Jesus would have had to control how much blood flowed out of the wound by sheer willpower. It just doesn't. The alternative explanations are far harder to believe than the gospel account.
Well, you get this goofy notion that Jesus faints or passes out from the ordeal, that he's thrown in the tomb, has a cup of herb tea or something, you uh-huh. know, a Red Bull, and then he's ready to go, and uh-huh. he's out showing himself to be. It just absolutely is so implausible on
even
its face.
Even rationalists like Strauss and Remarus said, no,
he was dead. All of them just hate that stuff.
Robinson, even the liberal New Testament scholar, says that he was dead is as clear as yeah. anything that we can possibly know about the historical Jesus.
Bultmann, too, yeah.
Here's another clip from my interview with skeptic Michael Shermer.
People believe all sorts of weird things. You know, the Jim Jones people killed themselves in his name, and the, you know, the Heaven's Gate people did the same thing, and the, you know, Waco Branch Davidians. I mean, people, you know, there's almost 10 million Mormons that believe that Joseph Smith talked to God, and my guess is you don't believe that. Well, why not? They have witnesses. If you look at the first page of the Book of Mormon, it's an affidavit signed by the witnesses who all saw the gold tablets. They heard the voice of God speaking to them and so forth. How is that any different?
So what about the Mormons with all of their historical evidence?
If you've ever talked to a Mormon, they're not interested in the truth claim. The Mormon faith is that Jesus appeared to Indians in North America or whatever. But the average Mormon doesn't, his concern that he's had the burning in the bosom, it doesn't matter what Joseph Smith said. And if it did, they'd be panic stricken. Somebody, for example, took the dimensions of the gold tablets and calculated the weight of gold and figured out how big those things were. They weighed like 800 pounds. Just on its face, it's impossible that Joseph Smith carried those things around as it's claimed in the Book of Mormon. Then there's the DNA.
Yes.
The DNA evidence is going to prove that Native Americans are not Hebrews, and that is the claim made. So Mormonism is a religion that's on, it's a social religion, it's tied to tradition and family, and personal experience.
Yeah, and I think it's worth bringing up, as you have, we don't know a priori what will be the case in something like Mormonism. In other words, you're stuck with having to go into, in Craig's field, what are the facts? And there's no way of transcending that. If you're going to make a historical claim to found your religion, then for good or ill, it's incumbent on you to say this is what the historical case is.
Yeah, and if you're a critic of Christianity, as Michael Shermer is, rhetorically what you're going to do is very different from what a scientist or historian would do. A scientist or historian actually has to, you know, go inductively, piece by piece, look at this, separate the different hypotheses into more plausible, less plausible. He doesn't do what he would normally do if he were a scientist or a historian. What he does is sets up a canon and shoots out all of the religions at you, mm-hmm. and says, look at all of the competing claims. You can't possibly imagine that yours is true. Basically, what he's saying is, I'm counting on your laziness. I'm counting on your simplicity. I'm counting on the fact that you're probably not going to analyze these claims religion by religion and your own by its historical record. What I'm counting on is just overwhelming you with a barrage of things you can't handle or pick apart or analyze. Yeah. Isn't that basically what he's saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a classic case of staying above it, not getting dirty. Skepticism is just the easy way out. I mean, it's easy to be a skeptic and just challenge everything and land nowhere.
Look at all the different interpretations of something as near to us as the Civil War.
Or how about 9/11? Yeah. I mean, you've got people out there saying it's a conspiracy involving political figures, etc. Just because there's disparate viewpoints doesn't mean
right.
that there's a viewpoint that takes into consideration the facts and the evidence and is, in fact, the proper
right.
understanding of the event.
Right. Right. There are viewpoints and there are viewpoints and there are viewpoints.
Right.
And a scientific and genuine historical critic is going to say, this one seems to be the best supported. Right. These seem not to be.
In Surah 4, 157, Islam's Quran teaches that the Romans, quote, never killed him, but were made to think that they did. Okay, so for example, you got to do this case by case. Look at Islam. What does Islam say about Jesus dying? Well, he didn't really die. They were made to think that they did. Okay, now is that plausible?
Objection here for a moment, please, Your Honor. Hearsay, that document comes, what, in the 7th century?
Right.
That's giving you information about what happened in the 1st century. There is no court of law in this country ever that would accept the opinion of Muhammad or in the Quran about what happened in the 1st century. No scholar that I'm aware of ever uses the Quran to talk about what actually happened in the 1st century.
So it wouldn't even be admitted into
Absolutely
evidence?
Absolutely not admitted.
Let's look for the best explanation here then. First of all, Jesus' body was stolen. Is that a good explanation for the empty tomb?
It's been the earliest and probably the one that should be gone after first or the most energy given to it. And we all know, at least from reports, people who have really, really believed strange and weird things, truly believed them, and they've even believed them to the point of suiciding or dying. The question here, though, is, in this case, would nobody cop to we invented it even at the point of execution? Now, granted, mm-hmm. that's a psychological argument, but if I were in that place and had constructed it, I would have said, I think I'm going to rethink my position.
At a certain point, this party's over.
Yeah,
it was a good idea for a while,
yes.
but now I'm dying.
Yes.
One of the best things Chuck Colson ever wrote was shortly after his conversion. He's got a chapter on the Watergate conspiracy and how here are all these highly trained lawyers who knew what was going to happen to them if this leaked out. And, of course, it's a process crime. The cover-up's worse than the original offense. Here are these men, highly educated, involved in the most important levels of government, hardly Rube fishermen like the disciples.
Right, right.
And they couldn't keep a secret for a day.
Uh-huh.
Colson's analysis is brilliant on the intrigue that starts in the group, people wondering, well, is he going to talk? No, is he going to talk?
Right.
And so that starts this whole inner dynamic where they all turn on each other immediately because no one can trust anybody else.
Right.
It's just psychologically impossible that these 12 fishermen kept this hidden.
What about, we've talked about it a little bit, but Jesus didn't really die, but he was nursed back to health.
Take a look at it. See if you can get yourself to believe that he fainted on the cross, didn't die, in the cool of the tomb, was sort of resuscitated from his swoon, and then, as Kim said earlier, had a Red Bull and went about convincing people he was risen from the dead.
One of the things that strikes me, too, is not just the events right there that kind of count against this swoon theory, but the complete implausibility of Jesus of Nazareth being nursed back to health. He's feeling a lot better now. The whole idea that Jesus grew old, maybe got married, had a few kids.
Went to India.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, first of all, would he shut up? No. Given his history, given his record leading up to his arrest, Jesus would not have said, okay, wow, I'm not going to do that again.
Time to join a fraternity in Nigeria.
Yeah, not going to do that again. That was hot water.
Well, and the other thing that I think has to be dealt with, Christians don't venerate the tomb. They don't venerate a particular place because they're aware that Christ is present in their midst.
The other thing is a passage in John's Gospel that's in part of the Thomas account, badly preached, I think. The section that says, "And Thomas, you have now believed because you have seen? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed."
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of idiocy preached on that, kind of an anti-intellectual, don't ask questions. But I think what's behind that is what I've provided for you empirically is enough. And I'm not going to triple that or do more in the future for every Tom, Dick, and Harry that challenges it. The record by the eyewitnesses will suffice.
Mm-hmm. If the sign of Jonah is not going to convince them, they're not going to be convinced.
How about the Easter experience was a spiritual vision, not a literal appearance of Jesus bodily raised?
Refuted by the witnesses who said they saw him.
Yeah. Jesus ate fish.
Yeah. And he said, does a ghost have, I'm not a ghost.
Right.
Do ghosts eat fish?
Right.
Or to Thomas, come over here and touch and be no longer unbelieving but believing.
Another point that Tom Wright makes too that I think is interesting on this one is he says visions from loved ones is never in any society evidence that they're alive. Visions are evidence that they're dead.
Yeah, it's like the last scene in Star Wars where Obi-Wan and the rest of them appear to Luke.
Hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it's evidence that they're not here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a spiritual vision, which it amounts to the liberal, quote-unquote, Easter experience really is nothing more than mass hallucination, right?
Sure.
Right.
And that's being nice to it.
Yeah.
And again, not based on the text. I mean, this is based on later interpretation, not by the people that were there. Look at the people that were in the presence of Christ himself. You can't possibly get out of that. It's a spiritual resurrection.
Right.
Regardless of what contemporary scholars think happened, it's indisputable, isn't it, that the first Christians testified to a physical resurrection?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
So they have priority.
Yes.
So if you're someone like Bishop Spong, if you have integrity, you say, I don't believe them. I don't believe that there is anything meaningful after the crucifixion of Jesus for us today.
But I think probably I shouldn't be drawing a check as a bishop.
Yeah. But see, he's beginning with the doctrine of the anti-miraculous. The resurrection can't occur, so what can I come up with to explain it? Instead of letting the facts speak for themselves, right. Even though it presents an event that's unique,
mm-hmm.
maybe non-recurring, but the evidence supports that that's indeed what happened.
I want to read a quote from Bishop Spong from his book, Resurrection, Myth or Reality. At its very core, he says, the story of Easter has nothing to do with angelic announcements or empty tombs. It has nothing to do with time periods, whether 3 days, 40 days, or 50 days. It has nothing to do with resuscitated bodies that appear and disappear or that finally exit this world in a heavenly ascension. There are a lot of people who are regularly treated to these kinds of sound bites from...
By the way, did he happen to say what was the core of it?
The Easter experience,
okay.
that Jesus is still with us today because his impact
Got it.
Is still available to anyone who will just have the faith. So now it's on us, not on history. It's up to you to have the faith to
experience
the Easter
presence of Jesus.
And this is a way of accommodating the modern worldview. A modern worldview, by the way, which even in the sciences is passing away, but nevertheless is firmly in place for a lot of those who were educated in that modern worldview in their graduate studies and seminary studies in the 1950s and 60s. Yeah, isn't it significant, too, that someone, for example, like Pinchas Lapid, a Jewish scholar, who, though remaining Jewish, did not embrace Jesus as the Messiah, nevertheless argued in a controversial book that from within the perspective of Judaism and what we know of the first century and from the reliability of the witnesses, I can only conclude that Jesus rose again on the third day,
right,
and it's only the really Gentile Greek bias of liberal scholars that can say that didn't happen.
Right. There is definitely a resurrection to Lapid. The question is, it doesn't prove Jesus' deity.
Right.
But of course, if you ask the one who accomplishes resurrection, what does it mean? And he says, by the way, it means I'm God. That's your best witness for the topic.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In fact, this is what Pinchas Lapid says. I cannot rid myself of the impression that some modern Christian theologians are ashamed of the material facticity of the resurrection. Their varying attempts at dehistoricizing the Easter experience, which give the lie to all four evangelists, are simply not understandable to me in any other way. Hmm. Indeed, the four authors of the Gospels definitely compete with one another in illustrating the tangible, substantial dimension of this resurrection explicitly. Isn't there a kind of arrogance when a modern liberal like Spong says what the Gospels actually communicate has nothing to do with what is real, what really happened? I know better than the eyewitnesses what this event means.
It reminds me of Lewis talking about the critics trying to reconstruct his own writings, and he said you'd think that they would get something right. They're in my culture and in my day. But as a matter of fact, they have a perfect record of failure. Now, these critics are asking us to imagine that they can, 2,000 years removed, and from a completely Gentile culture, tell us the real story. And I think that has deep scholarly problems.
Right. When somebody like Bultmann tells you he's going to demythologize Scripture, no, what's really going to happen is you're going to get true mythology. Because you're going to leave the historical record and you're going to get the personal opinions of who's
important. But at least Bultmann will move this into the genre of myth. And so he'll see some coherence to the original story that's mythological, whereas a guy like Spong just acts like the story isn't even there. It's that much worse than Bultmann.
And so the questions that have to be asked, at least John Levinson, Pinchas Lapid, Geza Vermes, at least these Jewish scholars are saying to Gentile Protestant liberals, okay, come over here for a second. You don't have a choice here. You can say with us that he's not God incarnate. You can say with us, except for Pinchas Lapid over here, that he didn't rise from the dead. What you're not allowed to say, given the Jewishness of this story, is your own Greek Gentile story about just going to heaven when you die. The resurrection of the body and life everlasting is the only thing that could be possible. Either that did happen or that didn't happen. You don't have a second prize.
And they're thinking in terms of immortality of the soul in Greek philosophy.
Yeah. That's not enough
state
for us. That's not they affirm, John Levinson has written a book on this, saying that Jews do affirm and did affirm in Jesus' day the intermediate state, but that wasn't salvation. Salvation was the resurrection
of the body
on the last day, and there was no room in Jewish eschatology at all. You were a Sadducee who denied it or a Pharisee who affirmed it, but there was no room at all in the Jewish worldview for any idea of a resurrection that wasn't physical and bodily.
Goodness gracious.
Wow.
What that would do to the speakers at SBL,
Society of Biblical Literature.
Yes, this would decimate the papers.
Well, I think that one of the reasons why there has never been a better day to defend the resurrection claim today is precisely because after the Holocaust, the anti-Jewish bias of Protestant liberalism was exposed.
Yeah.
And there was this circle, University of Heidelberg, for example, with Gerhard von Rad and Gunther Bornkamm and others, to recognize the Jewishness of Jesus and the Jewishness of the whole New Testament.
Uh-huh.
Man, does that put things back in perspective.
Uh-huh.
Protestant liberalism is basically the Gentilizing.
It's Gentile Sadduceeism.
They don't like the cross. Yeah. They don't like
blood, sin,
atonement. Yeah.
Sacrifice.
The more you put the New Testament in its Jewish context, the higher original sin, substitutionary atonement, justification by faith, all of this, either you deny that Jesus is the one who accomplished that, or you affirm it. But Jews and Christians agree, being declared right before God so that you will be raised in the resurrection of the just is central to the hope of Jews and Christians alike. Now the question is, was Jesus the one?
Yeah, right. Wow.
And you're hearing this more and more in evangelical circles, especially with people like Brian McLaren and others in the emergent church circles. Rob Bell, in his latest book, Love Wins, where the thing that stood out to me in that book was not that he denied the reality of hell. What stood out to me was how Gentile everything else was when he says, for example, that, cross and Easter represent what has always and everywhere been true for everyone. And that's why we have baptism and the Lord's Supper. These are not exclusively for Christians. They symbolize what is true everywhere for everyone already.
Wow. Spring will arrive.
Yeah.
Yo, isn't it nice?
Just one question. The verse for that is?
First Voltmann.
Yes, yes, exactly. The text is what again?
Well, and again, when I read those, I just scratch my head and say, would this have occurred to a first century Jew?
Right.
Not just a Christian,
right.
To any Jew in the first century.
And it's
who
been,
wasn't
no.
influenced by Athens.
Right. And it's been tried before.
Yeah.
That's why we keep mentioning Protestant liberalism.
Yeah.
Here's a final clip. If there is no divine mind or super intellect outside of the universe and all we have is the infinite chaos of blind forces, then isn't reason itself a product of the wind in that analogy? Haven't you just proved that reason's kind of like that sentence behind the paint shop? No one wrote it. It's meaningless.
Well, our brains, yes, are designed to reason. But what else have we got? That's the best tool we have to make contact with reality. That's all we have.
So he doesn't actually answer the question. He doesn't offer an account. He just says, well, that's the way it is, and it seems to work. Here we're offering answers and accounts and reasons, and yet in the name of science, a skeptic like Michael Shermer is shrugging and saying, well...
But it isn't science. He is asserting something, and that's a long ways from defending. If you're in contemporary science, you are not going to spend your time as if science hadn't come anywhere since Newton. You're going to flee a priori, and you're going to give precedence to whatever the data are, regardless of your overall beautiful plan. Your plan is vulnerable to the least fact that stands against it. And these people operate as if Newton was the last scientist.
Well, aren't we as Christians saying all along that God himself says, test me by what I do. Look at my track record. That's how you believe my promises.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying that the very nature of Christian revelation requires us to use reason ministerially. We don't discover
right.
that revelation.
Right.
But God requires us to test it.
He imagines that we know it by divine light bulb.
Yeah, and that's not the nature of God's revelation himself anyway.
Not in Christianity, it's not. And not in Judaism.
Yeah.
And with God incarnate, God says, look at my wrists and feel my side. And the eyewitnesses did. And we have, what strikes me is from Hume all the way to Bishop Spong and Michael Shermer— Critics, skeptics have said, well, we weren't there. We can't verify whether these things happened because we weren't there. And N.T. Wright has had a brilliant one-line zinger that sort of kills that dead. He says, well, then nobody can do history at all.
Yeah, right. Exactly right.
What historian was there at the, as an eyewitness of the events that...
And the impression is given that, that the scientific mind is doing this with facts and not with doctrine.
Oh.
And you're starting with doctrine, where Chesterton says actually just the opposite.
Right.
You are a priori eliminating looking at facts because of your doctrine.
Right.
It's
mm-hmm.
actually the person who comes to the facticity of the resurrection through the facts who's doing this scientifically.
Uh-huh.
Just the opposite of what Shermer says.
I think that gets back to the original point that he's above it all. He's given this a synthetic a priori, so he doesn't have to get himself dirty. Mm-hmm. And face it, Christian Revelation's tough going. It's hard to go through these passages and look at them on their face and figure out why there's John's gospel that's structured differently and why mm-hmm. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have slight discrepancies. We've got to get in there and tackle these things and explain them. He just glibly dismisses the whole process. He's above it all. He's not going to get in that frame because they're all different kinds of religious claims, and how do we know? And skepticism
kind
easy.
Of juvenile, actually.
It's juvenile and easy.
Yeah.
It's a cop-out.
Rod, you were talking about an article by Michael Roos, Florida State scientist,
yep.
who is well-known for his criticisms of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story this past Easter.
This comes from the latest edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Title is Easter Morning, author is Michael Roos. This is Easter Sunday, the most important day of the Christian year. This morning, as always at 7, I was out in a local park with the dogs. It was deserted and misty, and as I climbed the hill, the sun ahead started to shine through and down on us. I felt, as I always do on this day, the pull of the Christian story. There is pain, humiliation, abandonment, and finally death. And then the sun bursts through, and all is made clean and meaningful. The Lord lives. Yet for all that I can share, the sense of drama and worth, it is not for me. It really is not. I'm not telling you about my emotions to prepare you, or more importantly me, for a Road to Damascus experience. I am a non-believer, and I'm going to stay that way. I am not going to change, and I don't want to change. Why? Partly it is psychological. Having had one nasty bullying headmaster in this life, I sure don't want another in the next. Partly it is philosophical. I simply don't want meaning and eternal life on the back of the suffering of Anne Frank and her sister in Bergen-Belsen. Nothing can make that worthwhile. Partly it is theological. I just don't think there are easy solutions in this world. Any meaning has to come from us, from within, and not imposed from without. Naturally or supernaturally?
Well, I mean, it's hard to find anything more beautifully expressed
right.
in terms
right.
of the honesty and so forth. But you do detect there, again, as with other critics like Michael Shermer, a kind of dogmatic attachment to unbelief that matches the sort of dogmatic attachment to belief that is just as unfounded among many religionists. And so, you know, you wonder, I will not. I don't want to.
Right.
It's not
the verbs are telling.
It's not that he's not drawn by the truth of the story. He will not believe it. And he can't bring himself emotionally and psychologically to accept the implications.
And to this response, I think the Christian church will say, you will get exactly what you want, which is Lewis's point. There are two types of people, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy will be done.
Yeah.
It makes me curious whether he ever in his childhood had the experience of someone doing grace and blood really well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because his image of God, he refers to a bad headmaster in school, but his image of God, whether it's that person who shaped it or something else, doesn't seem to have been exposed to someone who would shape it otherwise.
Right. That's right.
Well, if what we've said here isn't in fact the case, if the resurrection, bodily resurrection of Jesus, isn't the answer for the historical evidence that we have, then as Paul said, we are of most men the most to be pitied. There's no point in this great commission. There's no point in us going to church. There's no point in us teaching the Bible to our families and our children. It's all a hoax. It's all a lie. And the Great Commission stands or falls on the message that Jesus mandated us to take to the ends of the earth. So, no resurrection, bodily resurrection, no Great Commission, no point for any of it.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.